Today at Radio Verulam, we're once again speaking to one of your local MPs to get the answers to your questions. And thank you this month from everybody here at Radio Verulam. This has been the record month for questions, involvements with the political broadcast. Thank you so much, and please do keep those questions coming in. I know some people will be disappointed that they didn't have their questions answered this month, but we talk to our politicians every month, so there's a chance when they're back again next month, if your questions are relevant, they will be asked then. But without further ado, let's go in to the Q&A session. Welcome back to the show, Bim. We took a break last month in line with parliamentary recess, but the work goes on, doesn't it? Was it just as busy as always for you during this time?
Yes, because there was a sort of weird hybrid between people, certain things not happening because of COVID still, and that's because people's different risk appetites as to when they want to go and do things, but also a lot of people wanting things to go back to normal. So there were a few village fetes, there were physical things to turn up to, on top of the, you know, the continuing sort of Zoom calls and all the rest of it. But, you know, overall, I can't complain. I was just feeling so happy to be able to do things.
And was it a little bit strange as well that Parliament did get called back for the Afghan situation? It was a debate. I mean, did that interrupt a lot of people's kind of recess there?
It did, but you didn't have to come back. There wasn't a vote. So if you were there, it shows that people weren't having that much fun on holiday with their children or whatever. So I was there. That is not the reason. Well, at least that is not the whole reason why I was there. No. The truth is, whether politicians admit it or not, they rather like when they're called back on holiday, because what it does is it makes them feel part of what is otherwise, you know, it is the main thing going on in international affairs at that time. And there's only one thing worse than MPs feeling they have to work on the holidays on something like that. It's MPs not being asked to do any work because they therefore don't feel involved. They don't get a chance to chat to the Foreign Secretary and their colleagues and the Prime Minister about what's going on. And all of that is so important. So it was, I think people were happy to come back to discuss an issue of real importance, as you can see by the absolutely full chamber.
I mean, that's a fascinating insight then into the fact that, you know, you as MPs, I think quite often people look from the outside as, oh, what do MPs do? But you feel duty bound in these situations. You actually want to get your teeth stuck into these discussions.
Of course, because if you don't turn up to when the biggest foreign policy thing really over 20 years, other than Iraq, then what are you doing? You know, a member of parliament is not a local councillor. You are there to vote and debate and discuss and be part of national issues and international issues. You know, as recently I've been appointed PPS to the Foreign Secretary. International issues are of huge importance to MPs because your job is not just looking after, you know, working with your local council and local things. It's a national and international thing. And being part of that is a key part of the job, I think.
Well, you've actually highlighted my next question. Since we last talked, congratulations are in order because you are now the Parliamentary Private Secretary to the Foreign Secretary. I mean, how happy are you with this new role? And what are your new duties?
Look, it's a real privilege to be PPS, the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, who I know quite well. And you know, the duties are different insofar as the Foreign Secretary spends a lot of time abroad. The main role you have is being the eyes and ears of the Foreign Secretary in the Commons. And that's particularly important because the Foreign Secretary spends so much time not in the Commons. So Foreign Secretaries tend to lose touch quite quickly with the political opinion back home, and it's my job to make sure that doesn't happen.
In a recent interview, you actually explained how you have 4 days in Parliament and then 3 days to kind of work in the local constituency. Because this is obviously a foreign secretary role, does that mean that you'll be taking more time maybe abroad, or will this involve more time maybe away from your constituency?
No, it shouldn't mean that. It's frankly, before this, you know, I've been engaged in international issues. I'm something called a Franco-British Young Leader, which is a group convened. President Macron's team picked a bunch of people. The UK side picked a bunch of people, not just in politics, but in sort of civil society, military, private sector, and sort of working very closely to build Anglo-French relations for people under sort of 45. I've also been on trips to China, looking at how the Chinese do lots of things. I've also been, you know, trips to Germany, which is a language that I speak, and have been very involved with, I'm getting more involved with some of the politics there. So actually, you should be doing that anyway as a member of parliament, because having links and people you know in different countries is really, really important. And indeed, the United States is a country I know well and have been on a trip to as well. So you will continue to do those things, but this time, I suppose, you might do it with a bit more knowledge and understanding about what the British government's doing and what the Foreign Secretary's aims are.
A lot has happened since we last talked, so this is why we've got quite a beefy introduction section here. And also, since we last discussed things, you released the information regarding your first responses to your 2021 constituency survey. What kind of insights did you get?
There are two big things I took from this. One is that people are really quite engaged, more engaged than they've been for quite a long time. And they're engaged across a wide range of issues. There was, what would have made my life a lot easier is if there were just two things or whatever, or three things, the only things people mentioned. But then I knew, I would know that there are only three things I need to talk about. But actually, it's very, very widespread. It's a mixture of local and national. There's a, I'd say if I were to say, if there was a steer, I'd say there were people who were concerned about local shops, local high streets, local business, that was coming through. And also the environment also comes through. Though the environment gets manifested in different ways. You know, some people care about woodland, some people care about house building, some people care about slightly different things. So that's how it gets manifested.
And will this help you going forward, you know, helping you to help the community?
I hope so. That's the point of it.
Yeah.
So really, the purpose of it is twofold. It's to show people that you actually want to hear what they have to say and that you're listening. Because the truth is, though you are listening, it's important to show people that you are. And the second thing is that you find out stuff you didn't already know. And when you find those things out, you can then act on them. And often they're very localized things, but also they're things that you go, gosh, I had no idea people were bothered about that. I'd say in local terms, road safety was a real issue. People care about things that are happening often literally on their street. And so what my office does is we then get in touch with the local councillor and say, look, there's a problem on that street. And then that gives us that information. So it can be really, really useful.
What would happen in a situation, Bim, I don't know if this has happened to you ever, but say if your constituents, say in the survey, said an issue that you weren't aware about, but it was something that maybe you didn't agree with, would you reach out and try and come to like a compromise in the community if it was that important?
All the time people say things that I don't agree with. Now that's me not agreeing can be because of some policy reason, or it can be because I have a piece of information they don't have. And so therefore I understand why something's being done and they don't. Not because I've got some superior level of doing it, but just because I know, because of my job, I know things that other people don't know. So that quite often happens, and you've got two options. You either explain why you think somebody has an incorrect understanding of something, or you explain that, look, you maybe have a difference of opinion, but this is why this is going on. But where it's hardest is where I, as the Member of Parliament, have no ability to affect the scenario that someone's complaining about, even if people think I do. Planning is a very good example of that. You know, I literally have no jurisdiction over planning whatsoever in the local area. And yet quite often people will seek to me to try and do things in relation to planning developments and things, which I literally cannot do. I have no power to do that. And that can be tricky, because often you will agree with somebody, but then you won't really be able to do anything about it. And people often don't really understand, well, if you agree with me, why are you not doing something about it? And so really it can be quite complicated in that regard.
Let's move the attention to Parliament. And you discussed a fascinating insight into the way that it runs when you described that each week you enter departmental oral question ballots to try and raise constituency issues in the House. However, you said that unfortunately a small number of questions get chosen and MPs rarely get to raise every issue in the chamber that they would like. Do you feel that this is something that should be changed about Parliament going forward? Maybe each MP can raise one local issue each week.
It just wouldn't be practical. You've got 650 MPs. How would that work? Right. I think you've got to... I don't think that could work. What you have, however, is the ability for MPs to apply for Westminster Hall debates or adjournment debates in the Commons and Chamber, and they can be on the most local issues. I've held them on Luton Airport. I've held them on planning. I've held them on financial services. There is the ability to bring to the House of Commons a very local issue, but I just don't think you can get to sort of every MP having something every week. I mean, you'd never deal with anything else.
So across the country, many have united in the plight of helping Afghan refugees. What is being done in your local constituency, and how can people help?
The answer is, I don't know. I don't know exactly what has happened with the local councils. I know the local councils, I think, are very amenable to taking refugees, but as of yet, I have not been told of any refugees that have been resettled in this constituency. So if anybody's listening who thinks that's incorrect, and there have been, I'd love to know whether that's happened, but I have not been told that's happened.
And I suppose, is this one of those things, like you said just a few moments ago, where people might think that you do have jurisdiction over it, but this is actually a council issue?
Well, it's completely a council issue. I literally have no power over it, but the councils are working with the government on resettlement, and that is quite a complicated process. There's a lot that has to go into that. For example, if there are existing family members in parts of the country, refugees may want to go to that part of the country. So, but I'm afraid I really don't know in relation to this area. It's possible that people have been resettled here that I don't know, but I don't think it's been the case so far.
Let's move to the petrol supply situation. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said that the situation is starting to ease. But with the HGV shortage still continuing, is it inevitable that something else will have a shortage very soon?
Well, there's a shortage of HGV drivers across Europe, and we have a similar shortage. Almost everything that you get in a shop or you might order online needs to travel from somewhere to somewhere else, and that will at some point be carried in an HGV, right? So does it necessarily mean there'll be a shortage? Not necessarily. It really depends how businesses and haulage firms operate. I know that Grant Shapps, who's my constituency neighbour, is sort of moving heaven and earth to make sure that we don't get shortages and everything else. And frankly, I hope that we don't, because there's a lot, everything from basic foodstuffs to medicines to various other things just need to be moved around. I think in the medium term, and I mean 12 to, a year to 2 years, we really need to make sure we build in more resilience into the system so that if you do get temporary dislocations, that the system can still function very well. And I think we need to work on that pretty urgently, yeah. The resilience versus efficiency is something we're going to have to think a lot about. And I think resilience is going to have, we're going to have to lean a bit harder into resilience and accept that at different times there will be more slack in the system.
One of the suggestions of curbing the crisis is the relaxation of rules around drivers. This is coupled with the fact that drivers have been allowed to work for longer hours. Is less well-trained people working more good hours a good combination on our roads, though, Bim?
Well, that's just assuming that the original system was the perfect system. I frankly think that we didn't need to have nearly as many consents and as many licenses and as many hurdles in the first place. So to me, I don't think people are less well trained. I think, you know, that's like saying, if we decided we needed a rule where someone needed to pass 5 driving tests to drive a car, if you lowered that number of driving tests to 3, does that mean people are less well trained to drive cars? Well, no, not really, because actually I think after 1 driving test, the vast majority of people are perfectly fine, right? So, you know, I think that we will not find there being any significant safety issue with HGVs as a result. The biggest safety issues with HGVs come from roads, speeds, making sure they're not driving too fast. You know, that is the big, they are the biggest safety issues, and they're not around training of drivers. That's around all sorts of other things.
So would you say that, in fact, this is the Conservative government actually removing barriers to entry that might have stopped perfectly well-trained drivers from entering the job sector for HGVs?
Well, it's not that they might have stopped. They did stop. Because if you put too many hurdles in people's way, people will just say, I'm not going to bother. I hope that this is a modest sort of relaxation of what were, you know, very strict rules, more strict, by the way, than in most countries, to a place that's very sensible. You know, as a society, you can't get to a place where in order to literally do anything, you need to pass all sorts of tests. It never used to be that way. And I think that what generally incumbents in people who are already doing something, any sort of trade or any industry, often seem to be very keen on imposing lots of tests on people wanting to come in because it maintains their wages, it maintains the scarcity in their industry. But I'm afraid, you know, the wider interest of society is that you keep a relatively low threshold for people to enter things because that keeps it buoyant.
Let's bring the attention back to the local area. And you announced your backing of the H-Town Pound vouchers to launch in Hitchin this month.
Very keen.
What is so good about this scheme, Bim?
Well, because it encourages people. This is effectively a local Hitchin currency. Independence for Hitchin. No, look, I'm joking. I'm joking about that. I don't want anybody to misconstrue. But look, it's really important that people shop locally. We all know how important it is, but all of us sometimes fall short of that, and I think we all appreciate that. So it's a good way to incentivize people to shop locally. They can get a little bit of a discount from shopping at the town centre with a particular Hitchin pound, or indeed it can work in any other town or city.
So have you already got some of your Hitchin pound notes at hand?
I haven't, but I will. In fact, I was thinking that just as you were saying. I was like, why has nobody sent me any? So I need to buy some. I do need to buy some. When I'm next in Hitchin, I will find
you. Have you got something in mind that you're going to buy with them as well?
No, but what I love about Hitchin is you just, because it's a real, you know, it's a big market town of a similar shopping size and sort of destination as somewhere like St. Albans, right? Really, though its population isn't nearly as big. So, you know, I go there and I'll do Christmas shopping there and I'll go and speak to shopkeepers and I'll wander around and I'll randomly buy things. And that's actually a joy of shopping in some way. You don't always come with a preconceived plan.
Let's move to the final discussion before we get into the community questions. And there's been a lot of criticism of the national insurance rate increase. Opposition leader Keir Starmer said that tax rise means a landlord who owns and rents out dozens of properties won't pay a penny more, but tenants working in full-time jobs will. Other commentators are saying that young professionals are being unfairly punished. Success is being taxed. Do you think that this is the fairest way to cover the problems with the NHS, Bim?
Well, I don't want to raise taxes ever. I didn't come into politics to raise taxes. I didn't like it at all when it was first proposed, and Conservative MPs discussed this at length. But I sort of reluctantly came to the view that we needed to raise tax quickly, and we needed to do that in order to speed up the rate at which we could bring down waiting lists in the NHS and deal with the social care problem, because of course the two are connected. And the advantage of national insurance is it's broadly based. So more people pay it. And by the way, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. You want it, everybody's going to benefit from it. So you want as many people as possible to pay it. If you're going to do it on income tax, you would have to raise income tax by more than double the amount. as a, in terms of the rate, so you'd have to put over 2p on income tax to raise the same amount. So it has that. There is a connection between national insurance and health and well-being that people understand. I think that's important. And in particular, by putting this specialist levy on, that will be identified as a health and social care levy, then everybody can see where that money is going. And I think that's very important. So look, I'm not saying I love it. I don't love increasing taxes at all. And frankly, we should always try and keep taxes down. But after examining all the options, I thought this was, you know, the least bad one.
How will the Conservative Party then protect the next generation of young people in this country?
What do you mean?
Well, so the commentators, as I said there, said that young professionals are being unfairly punished and success is being taxed. Is there another way that you will help or incentivize these people to be successful?
Well, I mean, this is the million-dollar question. And over the next couple of years, we're going to have to show people, younger people who are working hard, that this is a country and this is a government that will back them. And everything and their aspirations, everything from getting a job, setting up their own business, owning a home, and all the rest of it. Because if we don't, then we're finished. So, you know, it's up to us. It's not, there isn't one silver bullet because it's multifaceted, but that is the challenge. I accept the challenge. I don't think we've done enough. And I think we need to do a lot more. Because if we don't, then it's just a gross injustice on young people. And that will rightly be punished in political terms.
Let's move to the community questions. I have a sneaky feeling that you might disagree with what Chris has said here in the question, but I did want to ask it to you for fairness, because I've asked it to all the other MPs. He asked, what newspaper or news outlet do you think is best at the moment? He said he feels like a lot of newsprint is too sensationalist and leaning far too far to the right. Is there any good centre-left products? Now, I think at the end there, obviously, you won't be promoting centre. Well, you might be promoting centre, but maybe not left-wing products, Bim.
I agree that newspapers can be sensationalist, but I'm afraid that's a reflection on the public. If the public didn't want sensationalist, they wouldn't be like that. That's the first point. Second point is there's a lot of ideological variety in the press. And when I speak to conservatives, they often complain that so much of, for example, the broadcast media they think is very left, right? So I don't know, everybody gets to complain about something. If Chris wants a center-left quality product, I'd say the New Statesman I think is very good. And actually, I think they're genuinely thoughtful when they examine issues. I mean, I don't agree with everything they write, but I do think they try and examine them in a careful way. So I think you could take a look at that. And frankly, the FT has moved to the left in recent years, as has The Economist. So, you know, there's quite a lot there for you to choose from.
And what is your own favourite product to read and engage with?
I mean, the truth is I try not to read too many newspapers because I'm not sure you tend to enwisen yourself. Weeklies, I read the London Review of Books, which I love, The Economist, New Statesman, Spectator. So that's what I tend to try and read.
Ah, so interesting insight then. And one final comment that Bambos and Daisy said themselves was they like to read across the spectrum so that they know what the other side are discussing. Is this something that you like to do as well?
Yes, but the problem is the Labour side, they aren't really discussing anything. You've got the hard left, who obviously are talking about, you know, minimum wages of £25 an hour or whatever, but and complaining about Keir Starmer not being left-wing enough. But there isn't a huge amount of ideas on the hard left. So, on the centre left. So to be honest, I don't quite know. I do try and keep very abreast of what you might describe as sort of middling commentariat sort of metropolitan thinking is doing. And that's why I read the New Statesman, The Economist and the FT.
It's quite interesting because Bambos and Daisy said almost exactly the same of what you said, but on the right-hand side of the political spectrum. So it's just, it really
is. They would, wouldn't they?
It just, it is fascinating to see how the two sides, or, well, there's three sides, isn't there? Because there's three parties in discussion here. Just very similar views, but, you know, approaching it very, very differently. Let's move it to Nigel's question, though. He says, has there been any luck in getting Thameslink to restore rush hour services at our local stations?
Thameslink have told me they're doing a constant review of what's needed, because I think the difficulty is there are fewer people coming in at peak time. That's just fact. There are fewer people doing that every day. What we now need to really understand is what are the new patterns of travel? And, you know, they are constantly looking at it. That I've been told, and I've seen data that shows that trains are not as crowded as they were pre-COVID. So I don't think necessarily things are out of kilter at the moment, but I do think that's something we need to really watch very, very carefully.
And Nat has said on Twitter, you said that you had written to the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care to ask what steps the government is taking to improve young people's mental health as part of the recovery for the COVID-19 outbreak. What is being done nationally and locally, Annette would like to know?
A very, very good question, because I have not been told in any detail. And beyond just the normal, we've spent X billion pounds on mental health, which is fine, but it's difficult to know what that looks like. And I think it's a very good reminder from Annette that I should go and check out what's happening locally and see how that's filtering down.
Michael has asked, are government named and shamed 191 companies for paying less than minimum wage? But where's the punishment? If it is a fine, then surely that is just a business expense to them rather than a punishment. A proportional fine system for business size and amount of abuse should be brought in. Otherwise, it is just lip service and will give more businesses ideas to mistreat workers. Where do you stand on that question from Michael, Bim?
Businesses shouldn't mistreat workers. The fine is proportional, right? So if BP do it, then they get a bigger fine than the corner shop down the road. In addition, because I looked into this in detail, quite a lot of these were very individual instances. So literally once that happened, and there's some accounting quirk, or so actually it wasn't as widespread as it looked. And they've all been published. You know, that's a pretty big thing for a company. That you're published as well. So look, I think the fines are proportional to a large degree. People's names are in the public domain as not being very good employers. And I think that has a significant impact on how companies are seen and valued and looked at by the stock market, if they're public companies, and indeed by potential employees. So look, I think there isn't as much abuse of that as one might think. Bear in mind how many companies there are in the country. It was actually a very, very small number who are doing this. But let's make sure that number goes down to zero. And I think that by this public naming and shaming, that will do quite a lot.
So will this be a continuing policy then, that the government kind of names and shames till we get to as near as zero as possible?
I think it is.
So Mark has moved the question on to actually one of our interviews that we did in July. He believes, in his opinion, that you've been failed to give any real answer to the question on road safety, as this is one of your key initiatives. He feels that more discussion is needed on the topic. Could you ask Bim to expand on what progress has been actually achieved? How does he influence actions when it's local officials who have the say on the roads? That despite many years of discussion, nothing has changed in his opinion on the A5183. And ultimate, how is the elephant in the room being addressed? Local officials don't have money to tackle the issues raised by public, including Bim. There's a lot to unpack there, Bim. I don't know where you want to start.
Well, look, the truth is that they do have money. It's a question of priorities. So they do have the money to do certain things, but if they choose to rank something else more important, then obviously you don't have the money to do it. Right? So it's not that they don't have the money, and I'm sick of them saying it, because they do. Having said that, the real difficulty, to be very blunt, is that the interests are not, there are several interests when it comes to a road that is essentially a trunk road that is used. And the A5183 is a sort of very unusual road in this regard. there are lots of interests, because yes, there are interests of pedestrians. Yes, there are interests of other motorists, and there are interests of people who live nearby. The council has to balance a lot of interests. My interest is sticking up for my constituents. And I say, look, my constituents want, I don't know, a road straightened in a particular bit. They want the speed reduced. They want you to look at X. They want you to look at Y. But the council has all sorts of other interests as well. And so I have sympathy with the council insofar as they can't just listen to me and just do what I want, much as that irritates me. They often hide behind money. It's not really money. Often it's a sense of priority. And if they think that, and a lot of this ends up being political insofar as if they think they can do five projects in the county for the same amount of money it will take to do one project in my bit, then quite often behind closed doors, they think they'll do the five projects this year because then they can do five things off their list, right? So, and I'm not, by the way, saying that's the case in this particular scenario, I don't know. But that is the real difficulty. And look, in terms of progress, well, you know, unfortunately, I'm not a dictator in my constituency. I wish I was. And it means that I have to continue pressing, continue working with them, with people like Councillor Annie Brewster, who's been fantastic on this, and local residents like Mark and myself and others. David Lloyd, the Police and Crime Commissioner, who was very helpful in getting some speed, mobile speed vans to examine the speeds there. We also had an issue in the village of Sandridge from the road coming out of St. Albans. We also had a road safety issue there where we got some mobile speed camera vans there as well. So look, this is happening all over the place. And all we can do is continue to make the case, continue to press the council to make significant lasting improvements to the road network.
Freya has turned the discussion to an article that she read in the Observer. She said that the Observer released that thousands of emails to the Foreign Office from MPs and charities detailing urgent cases of Afghanis trying to evacuate over the last weeks have not even been read, including cases flagged by the government's own ministers. The rhetoric is always that people have to come through the right way, but how can they apply for asylum through government-specified methods when they are ignored?
On Afghanistan, because of my position as the Foreign Secretary's DPS, I'm going to just take a pass on this, because I'm not meant to speak on foreign policy issues as a PPS, and on this one in particular, I know how sensitive it is. Okay. So if constituent does want to write to me, I'm happy to sort of privately engage with her on it, but I should probably steer clear of that at this moment. But I'm very happy to deal with her individually, you know, if she comes to me.
Margaret has turned her discussions onto taxes and voter IDs. This is one that we have actually discussed before, Bim. So again, if it's something that you think we have already answered, then don't worry about it too much. But taxes are being put up, Margaret says, whilst the government is spending $120 million on illiberal voter IDs, although the costs will probably be billions, like test and trace. How is this justifiable over an issue with one prosecution in 2019? And she also sent me a quote of Boris Johnson and one of his quotes on voter IDs.
Well, I'm afraid if, first of all, 120 million is pretty small in the government budget. So, you know, it's not overwhelming our debt pile. And if you don't think that our democracy being safe from fraud is worth spending money on, I don't know what is.
With the Boris Johnson quote, though, I did send it to you. He said, on the streets of London or in any other venue, public or private, to produce my ID card as evidence that I am who I say I am when I have done nothing wrong and simply ambling along and breathing God's fresh air like any other freeborn Englishman. Then I'll take that card out of my wallet, physically eat it in the presence of whatever manifestation of the state has demanded that I produce it. I mean, there is, like Margaret has said here, and we have discussed this before, the question is that there is one kind of discussion point about IDs being too encroaching on people's freedoms. And then there is this introduction here of one of the most basic things, as you said, therefore, our democracy and freedom. Does that not counter each other out?
No, because if you're If you have to even go to the post office to pick up an Amazon parcel, you have to show ID. I mean, all this stuff about illiberal, it's just nonsense. It's so irritating. I mean, you to get something from the post office, you need to show ID, right? The idea that somehow to vote, and by the way, the reason why we're pushing this forward is every single politician has seen, and I know because I'm a politician, I've stood in elections, and I know there have been many instances where people have gone to vote and frankly, not necessarily been who they said they're going to be, where they who they said they've been. The reason why you don't have many prosecutions is because the threshold for the CPS going to take this to court is incredibly high. They've got enough to do. You know, this is the CPS that only managed to prosecute 2% of rape cases. They're not going to be clogging up the CPS for people sort of voting not according to the right name, right? So this is, I'm afraid, a nonsensical argument that irritates me greatly.
Tony has messaged in saying Buntingford is getting a net zero carbon school. Will these be the schools of the future across the country?
Yes. And I was recently at Roundwood Primary School in Harpenden talking to some parents, and there's an architect parent who I've been working with who wants to do something similar there. So I think this is exactly what we need to be doing, particularly with new school buildings.
So this could be something, maybe an exclusive here, that this is a project that you're working on to bring a net zero school to your area then?
Yes, I am. And I won't name the parent because then he'll, you know, be put under all sorts of pressure. But yes, I'm working with him on it. And hopefully we'll be able to get what my plan is to get it used as a sort of pilot, as an example, so that we can be a sort of national showcase for what a good example is. So that's the plan.
Rosie has asked, why are we messing with GDPR? This will add unnecessary red tape again for firms and will potentially halt a lot of trade with Europe.
I don't know enough about this, but what I do know is that GDPR in its current form is really not fit for purpose in many instances. So I think that we do need to look at it, but we also need to make sure that we're aligned in trade terms. So look, I'll take a more detailed look at that.
Sarah says, are you worried about the boundary changes to your constituency?
Well, worried isn't quite the right word. The truth is that boundary changes happen every 10, 15 years, and this is the next iteration, particularly in areas of relatively high population growth. Boundary changes happen, and so we'll see what happens. I like my constituency the way it is, but ultimately I don't get to choose my, you know, the boundaries, and I suspect that's a good thing, really.
Would you say then that you would be more sad if you lost certain areas of the constituency because you like visiting the people there, you've got to know them so well, and it'd be a shame to end those ties and relationships?
Oh gosh, it'd be such a shame, you're such a wretch to lose any part of the constituency. But you go into politics and you know that, you know, there is a reasonable chance that the constituency changes a bit, and that's sort of what happens. But, you know, there's still a long way to go on that, and we'll see what happens.
When is the likely outcome for that then, for people to know when changes?
By the end of 2022, they will have probably a near final map of what that'll look like.
Okay. So
late 2022, this time next year, I think around this time next year.
And the final question for this month's discussion in terms of local politics, Matt has asked, I saw you were at the opening of the new leisure centre. Will you be pumping some iron there in the near future?
Pumping some iron. Yeah, I need to work on that. I mean, you know what? I mean, I've never been a great one for gyms. I sort of can never quite get into it. It works very well for my wife, works so well for so many friends. I'm a sort of run in the park sort of guy, or take a long cycle sort of guy, because I like being outside. But as winter comes, I suspect I like to do things in the warm. So I may well, you know, I don't quite know what the right analogy is, don my leotard, that's for something else, lycra, that's it, don my lycra, and try and not be embarrassed in front of all these muscle-bound hunks that will be in the gym in Harpenden.
Well, it would be fantastic alliteration for, you know, a campaign, Bodybuilder Bim. Would you not want to become
no,
the...
No, that's a terrible idea.
You could have the tagline of the biggest MP in Parliament.
No. You're getting now to places where this is very dangerous. I think we should stop right now.
Well, that is, as you said there, a good point to end on, Bim. As always, it has been fantastic for you to answer the questions for the community, a lot of pressing ones. And I do have to say as well, Bim, this was the most popular month for all MPs. We had record numbers of questions sent in. So I do apologise to people that didn't have their questions answered. If they are still relevant for next month, then we will keep them in the system. But for now, Bim, I'm going to wish you the best of health. I hope you have a good month ahead until we chat again.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.